anyone's way so that no fault may be found with our ministry. All right? That's an indication of what Paul is trying to say, and what he's trying to indicate here is that he's trying to defend what he does. All right? And he claims that we look to make sure nobody finds any fault with what we do. I'd like for us to think about a word here that I think is a very important word in terms of our ministry, what we do here at the Chatham Church of Christ, and that's the word authenticity. Authenticity. Mm-hmm. We all want to be authentic Christians, don't we?
Yes,
and I think that's what we're trying to do here. Mm-hmm. And I just want you to see the kind of things that the Apostle Paul is going to say about his ministry that would lead us to adopt for ourselves. So what would make sure that we portray that authenticity to others? From time to time, I will read surveys or studies of various segments of society. We talk about Generation X, we talk about the millennials and various other generations, and there's a certain pattern that people seem to see about what generations think and why they think that way. I'm not real big on those things. I don't put a whole lot of stock in them because I think what happens is people look at those and they go, okay, well, we have to adjust our ministry to appeal to them, to appeal to this group or appeal to that group. I don't know. It just seems to me to get a little bit off on that when you're trying to appeal to people in a certain way. And one of the things that a certain group, a younger generation, seem to want is authenticity. People who truly live their lives for Christ, right? And a lot of people are not coming to church in that particular group because they don't see authenticity. And it's like, okay, I'm not sure that's a good reason why not to come to church. And sometimes I look at it and I go, okay, is that your reason or is that your excuse, for not coming? Be that as it may, the whole notion of authenticity, that's a legitimate concern, isn't it? Whether or not somebody's not coming because they don't see it, or whether or not there's some other reason that's happening, we still need to be authentic. So I don't want myself included to use the excuse that, well, I'm just not worried what they think about me. I'm worried about what God thinks. And in some ways, Paul was concerned that people didn't look at his ministry and find any faults in it. So we do want to do that. Whether or not we're just simply doing that to appeal to people, I'm not so sure that's the reason we ought to do it. I think the reason we ought to do it is because God wants authenticity. So let's think about that as we go through here. We're not trying to pander to anybody's interests. We're just simply trying to say we want to be authentic Christians. And I think Paul describes here, in some ways, what authenticity looks like. But I want to lay some groundwork before we get to this. There's a lot of details here, and I'm not going to bog us down in too many of the details. What I'd like for us to do is to look at a couple of the different contrasts in ministry that we see in the books. And we'll go back, first of all, and look at the difference between David and Saul, the first king. Saul was the first king, David was the second king. And I don't know how many of you are totally familiar with those two particular stories and what they did. I'll try to give you enough detail to help you see there were some pretty major differences in the way Saul went about things and the way David went about things. First of all, we talk about Saul, the first king. And one of the things we read about as we go through the book of 1 Samuel is we see that Saul was disobedient on a number of occasions. It wasn't just one thing. There seemed to be a pattern for Saul of disobedience, of not doing what God wanted him to do. And I believe as we read through the narrative, it becomes fairly clear that God could see Saul really was not fit to be a leader. You can go in and talk about, well, why did God choose Saul to begin with? I don't have an answer for you. I'll just say it right up front. I don't know. But it becomes very clear that Saul was not fit to lead God's people. And the consummation of that judgment comes in 1 Samuel chapters 14 and 15. Specifically, I think it's chapter 15, where Saul is told to do a certain thing, and he doesn't do it. He's told to go, and he's told to destroy this one town. And not take anything as booty, or as war reward. But he keeps back some of the sheep, and he sacrifices them. And when he's confronted, Saul tries to get excuses to Samuel. You know, well, I just kept back some of the sheep because I wanted to sacrifice to God. And that's where you get this statement that Saul makes, that's really, or rather that Samuel makes, that's one of the most profound statements about what God really wants from us. He just simply wants obedience. Sacrificing of animals, that's sort of secondary. It's not as important as the real thing, which is obedience. That's serving God. The thing that always gets me about this particular occasion is what happens when Saul is confronted and seems to admit that he said, yeah, okay, I sinned. But then he says to Samuel, well, come back and worship with me so that everybody can see. Now, he doesn't quite say it that way, but it's very clear. He said, honor me now before the elders of my people and before Israel, and return with me that I may bow before the Lord your God. You know what that is? That's a photo op. Saul wants to make it look good. And he wants Samuel to come back. Even though Samuel has confronted him, he said, look, you're not worthy to be king anymore. He says, well, just come back and worship with me so everybody will see it. That is a photo op. He just wants to make it look good in front of everybody. What we have here is what has been termed in various other places, symbolism over substance. That's what Saul is concerned with. Symbolism over substance. And that becomes fairly clear as the narrative continues on into David's life, when Saul becomes a jealous, paranoid man, concerned only with his image and with clinging to the power of the kingship. By contrast, his replacement, David, is said to be a man after God's heart. Now, that's we don't get that phrase until later on in the book of Acts. But it's very clear, and it becomes very clear, that even when he is anointed as the king, Samuel has to be told, Samuel, don't look on the outside. I see something on the inside of this guy that you don't see. I see a man who is willing to do whatever I tell him to do. And that's why Samuel has to anoint David. I believe David is the eighth of the sons that all parade before him. And he says, nope, not that one, not that one, not that one, not that one. Oh, yeah, the one that wasn't even there to begin with. You have to call him in from the field. And he says, that's the one. God says to Samuel, I see something in him that you just don't see. And that is, he is a man who will do whatever I ask him to do. And though David sins a pretty horrible sin later on in his kingship, his heart seems to stay true to God. 2 Samuel chapter 6, verse 16, verses 5 through 14, becomes very clear that even when David has to endure a coup in his own household, he says, well, maybe that's what God wanted for me. He's willing to endure that because it's maybe God's will. Peter calls him a man after God's heart. All succeeding kings are judged against David. David becomes the standard bearer of what it means to be a king, to be leading the people of God. So David versus Saul, David apparently had something inside. We'll call it authenticity. Is that fair? He was an authentic man, really concerned with doing the will of God. And apparently there weren't many like him other than people who followed him, and he became the standard for that. We move a little bit later on into the New Testament, where we see, I think, the more obvious contrast for us, at least, who are familiar with it. Jesus versus the religious leaders of his day, the Pharisees, the scribes, and so forth. I believe that, at least spiritually, the scribes and Pharisees were kind of the spiritual descendants of Saul. And the reason I say that is because they were very always concerned with image. They always tried to make it look good. Jesus says in Matthew chapter 23 and verse 4, they tie heavy burdens. They build up all these heavy burdens and they tie them on everybody else's shoulders, but they won't lift them themselves. They won't do what they know they're supposed to. They won't do what they expect everybody else to do. In Matthew chapter 23 and verse 5, Jesus accuses them of doing everything to be seen by others. Isn't that really what Saul did? Samuel, come back and worship with me so everybody will see you with me. All right? I'm not going to be the king. I'm not worthy. He doesn't say all that, but you know, that's kind of in the background. Here are a bunch of guys. They're just doing it all so everybody can see how supposedly righteous they are. Jesus had sort of hinted at this in Matthew chapter 6 when he talked about prayer, talked about giving alms, talked about fasting. He said, Don't do it so you can be seen by everybody else. You know, do those things between you and God. Don't let your left hand know what your right hand is doing when you give money. Well, you know, if my left hand doesn't have the same privilege as my right hand, why should I tell anybody else what I've done? Jesus is simply saying, look, do it with authenticity. Don't do it so that everybody can see what you're doing. In Matthew chapter 23 and verses 27 and 28, I think is sort of the culmination. In fact, this whole chapter is kind of the culmination of the conflict that Jesus had all the way through his ministry with this group. Here's what he says. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites! For you are like whitewashed tombs, which outwardly appear beautiful, but within are full of dead people's bones and all uncleanness. So you also outwardly appear righteous to others, but within you are full of hypocrisy and lawlessness. I'm sure Jesus wasn't surprised these people put him to death. You know, with that kind of conflict and confrontation. But he's really telling them who they are. He's really just pointing out to them, guys, he doesn't say it here, but I think he means it. You're just like so. You just don't have the authenticity that you need. You're simply trying to make yourselves look good, and it's not working. It's not working. Jesus himself, Luke 4, he brings good news to the poor. That was his ministry. In Matthew 9, we see him teaching and eating with those who really needed him. Remember when he says it's not the healthy who need a physician, but the sick? That's why I'm out here. You know, when we hear him make that reason, we say, well, that just makes perfect sense. But here's a guy who's really trying authentically to be out there among the people, talking to them, helping them, teaching them, trying to bring them back to God. He makes himself approachable in Matthew chapter 11, verses 28 and 30. He says, I'm humble of heart. You can come to me. Come to me, all of you who are weary and heavy laden. Come to me. Okay, I can be approached. He is the truly sinless man who can understand our weaknesses, as we've learned in Hebrews chapter 4 and verse 15. That's authenticity. That's real. He's not simply trying to put up an image. He becomes the true bearer of God's steadfast love and mercy. It's a pretty dramatic contrast. And he's trying to get his audience, specifically the scribes and Pharisees, to see that, guys, you're just missing it. You're just trying to put up an image. You're trying to be something you're really not. And again, it wasn't working. And it's from that point, from this point, I guess, we move to Paul versus his critics. Apparently, Paul has been criticized for various things. If you move over just for a moment into 2 Corinthians chapter 10, there are some rather interesting things that are said about the Apostle Paul, which are apparently used to kind of pull him down a few notches. And I'm not sure it worked all that well. Of course, obviously, long term it didn't, because whose letters do we have? We got the Apostle Paul's letters. We don't have letters or writings from any of these other folks that seem to be criticizing. But in 2 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 10, chapter 10 and verse 10. Listen to what they're saying about Paul. He says, for they say, his letters are weighty and strong, but his bodily presence is weak, and his speech is of no account. You know what that probably means? Probably means he wasn't a very good public speaker. You know, he didn't come across as a person with a lot of charisma. At least that's how I read it. And Paul will say at some point, you know, that didn't matter. I have knowledge. I have what you really need. Okay? I have something authentic to bring you. I may not be able to express it all that well. Seems to be able to express it better in letters. Or at least that's what his critics are saying. He's not very impressive. I don't know if they went away bored. We know at least one person went to sleep during the sermon, and that was a guy that fell out of a window. Okay.
You know, I guess preachers shouldn't feel too bad if people fall asleep once in a while. It kind of happened to Paul. Maybe that's a pretty good indication of authenticity. So, you know, go ahead and go to sleep.
No, I'm kidding. I don't want you to go to sleep.
But you see what part of what Paul is, they're trying to bring him down. They're saying, well, you know, he just didn't speak very well. He's not very polished. He's not very something about him. Well, Paul kind of returns the favor to them, and he says, they criticize his appearance and his speaking ability, but in chapter 10 and verse 12, Paul says, all right, now here's what they do. They compare themselves to one another. First of all, they're comparing themselves to Paul and say, well, you know, I can speak better than Paul. I don't know. Do you ever feel like you have to compare yourself to somebody else to either make yourself feel better or pull them down a notch or two? You know, well, I'm better than they are, you know. I've never had a speeding ticket. I mean, it's a simple thing, but, you know, you kind of get the idea that we compare ourselves to other people. We do that spiritually. Or we think our gifts are more important than others. Paul, that's another whole issue, but you know the idea. It has nothing to do with our worth in the eyes of God. It has nothing to do with our authenticity. Because it's not God, it's not them we're supposed to compare ourselves to. It's what God says about us. And it's really God's judgment that counts here. He kind of shoots back to in 11:13 for just a moment. He says, for such men are false apostles, deceitful workmen, disguising themselves as apostles of Christ. Paul pulls no punches when he says, here's their problem. But he's trying to defend himself. He's trying to make sure that he himself is authentic. And if we go back to chapter 6, he goes through a long list of things, which again, there's so much detail here, I'm afraid it would be way too much to give you in a sermon if I were to pick apart every little detail here. Suffice it to say, there are several things that we see here that Paul, first of all, he endures a lot of things, verses 4 through 5. And I don't think Paul's trying to brag here. He's trying to verify his own commitment to them. He says, I've endured a lot of things to kind of stick with this ministry. Not a matter of Paul patting himself on the back. In fact, there's some point in here where he says, I must be crazy to do this. I must be crazy to keep saying all these things about this boasting. Yeah, I shouldn't have to do this. But he goes on in verses 6 and 7 to talk about some moral characteristics of his ministry. And in verses 8 through 10, he talks about all the criticisms that he's had to endure as a result of his ministry. And all I kind of would like for us to conclude from all of this is simply what our lives would look like as a result of being us also representatives of the gospel. So I want to just draw a couple of conclusions from all this, even if I don't go into all the detail that Paul gives us. Just keep the word authentic in mind, okay? That's the word, is our sort of watchword for the day. Number one is, don't hide behind self-righteousness or a thin veneer of a few righteous deeds. You know, first of all, none of us need to do that to be accepted by God, do we? We know this. We know that our righteousness, as the book of Isaiah says, is like filthy rags. It's okay. God accepts us because of the blood of Christ. We don't have to try to prove ourselves to anybody else. And so, don't compare ourselves to others. Don't compare ourselves as a church to other churches. Don't compare ourselves individually to other individuals. You know, I try not to compare my ministry to other people, to other ministers. You know, ministers get together and the first thing they do is they talk about how many people will they baptize or all this kind of stuff. I'm in bad shape if that's the essence of my ministry. In fact, it wasn't even a pause in 1 Corinthians. He talks about that. And so the third thing I would say is endure hardships and disappointments. Paul endures a lot in verses 4 and 5. That's going to be a part of our Christian life, our Christian walk. We're just going to have a lot of disappointments. We're going to have some hardships. It's a package deal. We don't get to exclude them. We don't get to feel like everything's going to be hunky-dory because we're Christians. That's not going to happen. I wish it would, but it's just not. And so Paul's going to endure a lot because of the faith that he has. Number four, I would say, live our faith away from church, not only when you're here. Now, that's one I think we all know, but maybe it's just good to remember that. This is not something that we put on a good face when we come to church, or put on a good face in front of everybody. We live our faith when maybe it's just me and God, or me, God, and other people. We live our faith outside of these four walls. The whole point of our being here is to make ourselves stronger to do that, because that's what's really significant. That's what's authentic. Number five, recognize that the world will perceive us according to their standards. In verses 8 through 10, Paul talks about he endures his ministry through honor and dishonor, through slander and praise. We are treated as imposters and yet true, as unknown yet well known, as dying and yet behold we live. All those contrasts, I think, are the ways that the world looks at things. But Paul is saying, but we endure those things because the world is not going to understand a lot of these things. We just keep being authentic anyway. It doesn't matter in a way what the world thinks. It matters what God thinks. So we don't worry about their perceptions of us. Well, that's not exactly true. Paul wants to make sure people don't see any faults in his ministry, but don't do it just to be seen. You do it and then you kind of let the chips fall where they may. Number six is kind of an interesting one that we really didn't even look at all, but look at what he says in verses 11 and 12. We have spoken freely to you, Corinthians. Our heart is wide open. You are not restricted by us, but you are restricted in your own affections. In return, I speak as to children, widen your hearts also. So I would say that authentic ministry would also look like being really open to others. Okay, open your lives up to other people. And you can do that in a way of just maybe talk to people that you wouldn't normally talk to, or at least kind of have an openness about you that allows people to want to be in your circle of, I don't know, in your circle of discussion, in your circle of friendship. And I know you can't have everybody as your friend, but are you really just open to new people? Is your life open to one another here in this church? Okay. And again, that's a matter of how much you want to reveal about yourself, how much you want to trust certain people, and you don't do that with everybody, but there has to be an openness about our fellowship and about our church that, like Jesus invited people because he wanted them to see he was humble of heart, he kind of opened himself up and allowed that to happen. I think Paul is asking the Corinthians to do the same thing. Be open with one another and with others. Give your time to others, even if you don't have the resources. Now, I have to give my wife credit for that, because we were talking this week about something at the dinner table, and I said, you know what, that really fits with what I'm trying to say. Paul says here, he's living, though he's poor, but he's living to make many people rich. Right? He's living as if he is rich. And as we continue to discuss that, we kind of realize that, you know, one thing we all have, even if we don't have resources in terms of goods and money, we all have time. And we can all give our time to one another. We're rich in time. We're rich because God has made us rich in some ways that nobody else is rich. And you see, by giving our time to other people, are we not enriching their lives? We're enriching their lives because of what we are and what we have in Christ. And so, one of the authentic things we can do is to give our time to people. Think about that. And I would just simply conclude by simply saying, there's probably a lot more we could say, but we are striving for authenticity. That's what we're about here. That's what we should be about. But we should be about it in everything we do and say, whether it's here at church, or whether it's, you know, in our lives at home, whether it's at our jobs, wherever it might be, we're striving for authenticity. So my encouragement would be for each of you to keep striving for that. For those of you who may be new to us or learning about us, that's what we're about. And we want to encourage you to be about authenticity in your faith as well. Shall we stand together and sing a song of encouragement as we do think about that and consider it very carefully.